This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's Wild Oil of Oregano supports a variety of healthy benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is, among our series, our recent series of broadcasts on natural approaches to cancer. You know, these days we're taking a very targeted approach to cancer. We're trying to create magic bullets, in the words of Dr. Paul Ehrlich, who is a pioneer of conventional medicine of the early 20th century. We want to design very targeted laser-like therapies to interrupt certain metabolic pathways that may lead to cancer cell proliferation, interrupt cancer cell growth. It's called molecular medicine. These days it also has taken on the connotation of personalized medicine. We're going to treat not just the cancer, but the cancer that you have. And this is very promising in some ways, but we've come up with more and more cancer drugs that are incredibly expensive, costing perhaps tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars for several months of use. And many of them don't really pass muster. They may extend life by a couple of months. They certainly aren't curative, but they're offered to patients with the consolation that maybe they'll enable them to survive longer. But clearly, we haven't come up with the answer to cancer for the most part, although very, very promising research on many fronts. Today, we're going to talk about kind of a diametrically opposed approach. It's the metabolic approach to cancer. Our guest is Dr. Nasha Winters. She is a real pioneer and a star in the naturopathic community. She's an ND, a group of very academically focused naturopathic physicians are leading the charge against cancer these days. And she lectures all over the world, training physicians in the application of natural approaches to cancer, consulting with researchers on projects involving immune modulation. And we're going to look at some of those approaches today. But by the way, founder and CEO of something called Optimal Terrain Consulting. And that word terrain, Dr. Winter, is really a key to your approach, isn't it?
It absolutely is. Yeah. Thank you for letting me be here today with you.
My pleasure. Well, yeah, you know, it kind of goes back to the old debate, which I think you're very familiar with, between Dr. Louis Pasteur, who we remember, and some guy that we've completely forgotten. His name was Dr. Antoine Béchamp, and excuse my French pronunciation. But he was a guy who believed, in contradistinction to Pasteur. Pasteur, you know, invented the germ theory, believed that microbes were the end-all and be-all of disease. Béchamp used to debate Pasteur, and this is in the days before the internet, before TV, before movies. And so one of the entertainment venues was going to hear people debate important scientific issues, and they would have these lively debates, and Béchamp would say, that it's not about the microbes, it's about the terrain. And you certainly espouse that view when it comes to cancer, don't you?
Absolutely, I do. It's funny that you bring this up because I actually did one of my graduate thesis on this very topic, sort of the battle between the germ theory and the terrain theory. So it's near and dear to my heart. And we're actually reliving it. It's sort of like the modern day version of it in the somatic approach or concept, which is that gene-centric cancer target that you were talking about in the beginning, with the emerging metabolic discussions, which is definitely more terrain-centric. So it's sort of like our modern day flavor of this.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to terrain, well, let's look at it from the negative standpoint. What makes fertile terrain for the development and proliferation and spread of cancer?
So there's, you know, again, you could put 100 naturopaths, 100 functional medicine, 100, you know, very vitalistic medicine practitioners in the room, and we might all say something slightly different, but the undercurrent, the common denominator for us is that basically when you take it down to its absolute fundamental building block, we get down to things that make energy and things that deplete energy within our body. Pretty simple. Okay. And so when I think about that to its very kind of funnel visioned in concept, that takes us right down to those lovely little mitochondria that live within, you know, these are these little organelles within the cells of our body that are the little energy factories that basically make us go. Without them, or when they're not working properly, we don't work properly or don't even live. So coming down to that, that's sort of the what, but the why is where somebody like me starts to explore with patients or colleagues, you know, like-minded colleagues like myself. We want to understand what made that energy depleted or broken. And that's where we begin our discussion around the terrain-centric or kind of metabolic approach to cancer.
Well, in your book, you list the terrain 10. So 10 aspects of the terrain that maybe are amenable to lifestyle approaches, to supplements, to herbs, to natural interventions, even mind-body interventions.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've been at this for myself, for my own healing journey, but also that with thousands and thousands of patients, which is just finding patterns. I mean, I studied Chinese medicine. I studied Ayurveda for a long time, and they're both modalities that focus on the patterns, you know, and how they relate to the environment around them. And so I've kind of seen these 10 main patterns that have shown up in all the patients that I've had the pleasure of working with over these years. And they consist of things, you know, I guess I'll use a tree analogy in this moment because I'm very visual and we're on a visual or an audio discussion right now. So imagine sort of the canopy of a tree. That's our epigenetics. That's our blueprint that we were born with, but we certainly have the ability to change its expression so we can sort of rearrange the furniture, mm-hmm. if you will. We have the soil in which that tree is growing out of, which is our microbiome. A lot of great research coming out of that. As a naturopathic doctor, building on my tenets of philosophy, we believe that the gut is sort of the root of all health and disease. Mm-hmm. And so we're just basically a tube with the body wrapped around it. We want to make sure that's functioning properly.
And in fact, there's some very intriguing information lately, not just about the origins of cancer, but even assuming that you're going to go for a conventional approach to cancer, one of the most popular cancer chemotherapies, Daunorubicin, I believe it is interrupted by certain... I'm going to back up. Daunorubicin is interrupted by too many fat cells in the body. That's one way that lifestyle interacts with cancer chemotherapy. But certain new immunotherapies for cancer, which are not chemo drugs, they operate via the microbiome. And if you have a screwy microbiome, if you have dysbiosis, if you have taken too many antibiotics, if you've disrupted your intestinal milieu, the immunotherapies won't take. They won't be as efficacious. So that's a clear illustration of how the microbiome impacts cancer. But, you know, from your standpoint, it may play a role in the causation, the development, and spread of cancer as well.
Exactly. I really appreciate that you brought up those recent studies, and specifically, you know, for those listening, a lot of people have heard of Keytruda, also known as sort of the Jimmy Carter drug. Those are checkpoint inhibitors. And we're finding that a little, this, you know, like you said, where does it, is it a chicken or an egg scenario? But the natural checkpoint inhibitor within our microbiome that makes those drugs work better, but even without needing those drugs and prevention of the cancer, that organism is called Bifidus. And it's the most prominent gut, you know, microorganism in our youth, and it starts to naturally degrade over time. And unfortunately, what's happening is many of us are being born through C-section or lack of breastfeeding or different ways that we normally get inoculated, or we get wiped out with certain vaccinations or medications early on in life. And so our little bifidus backdrop is pretty depleted and sort of sets the stage for an ill-functioning immune system, which can get us in trouble, obviously.
Indeed. What are some of the other terrain 10 considerations?
Sure. So connecting that canopy of the epigenetics to the soil of the microbiome, we have this thick trunk, which is the mental emotional aspect, which has also been very downplayed in our culture and medicine. And, you know, we sort of split apart from, you know, the Descartes times of, you know, keeping our mind and our body separated out, but we can't, you know, weave those two apart from one another. They're inherently, you know, connected. So a lot of folks don't want to address that, or really don't like to be told that, you know, it's quote unquote all in their head, or that they've thought this into fruition. But addressing that part of the tree is very, very important. We even have an entire field like psychoneuroimmunology, so our thoughts impacting our immune system. And we've also learned things about like our ACE scores, our adverse childhood events, and how the more adverse childhood events you had before the age of 18, the higher your incidence of chronic illness and in particular cancer. So it's a big one to put some attention on.
Is there such a thing as a, you know, there's a type A personality identified with cardiovascular disease. They've since modified it to type H, which stands for hostility, not just type A, because I think I'm kind of type A, but I'm, you know, just not gnashing my teeth all the time and, you know, experiencing road rage. But the type C personality has been hypothesized as a precursor to cancer. What's that all about?
Boy, Hattie, I'm glad you brought that up, because there really is. And we tend to see in the population of patients that I see a lot of women. I think a lot of women are more drawn to coming to integrative practitioners anyway. That's what the sort of national statistics show. So I see that side of it. But they also tend to be people who are natural caregivers, who do not express their emotions very well or handle confrontation well or express their anger or hostility, if at all. And they also tend to put themselves last and be, well, for lack of a better word, a bit martyrish at times, because they do have that natural nurturing caregiver status, but they forget to turn it in on themselves until they have to.
Isn't there a pitfall in suggesting that mental attitude or personality or certain behavior traits predisposed to cancer? It's actually something that Susan Sontag once essayed about. She wrote an essay called On Cancer, where she said that, you know, one of the problems with integrative approaches to cancer is that sometimes we put the onus on the cancer patient. It's bad enough to get the cancer, and then you feel somehow responsible for cancer. Your thoughts allowed the cancer to develop and proliferate in your body. Is that, you know, something we got to be wary about?
Absolutely. And so when I'm working with a patient, I'm very conscious of expressing to them that this process, it is just that. It is a process. It is not an event. It's not like you went to bed one day and then woke up the next day with cancer. Most of the time, it's been on board for at least 8 to 10 years. All of us have these cancer cells in our body, but our body's communication systems and immune system, et cetera, are paying attention and keeping things in check until we kind of build up enough assaults to the system for the cancer to kind of get a run away. So where I'm sharing with folks in that idea of how our thoughts can affect our system and our relationships and the types of stress we put ourselves into or take ourselves out of, they absolutely play a role. And I think it would be just as irresponsible to downplay that And you're right about the way it's presented. This isn't a concept of it being your fault. It's a concept about lack of awareness. And once you know, you're empowered and you can do something about it. We are far more powerful than we're led to believe. And so it really helps people shift and change everything in their terrain to give them the best opportunity to completely overcome and heal.
And this is real science to this, is that, you know, measurably your levels of endorphins and enkephalins, which are the feel-good hormones generated by positive emotions, by exercise, by, you know, good things, that these actually have an immune supportive effect. They communicate with the immune system. They allow natural killer cells to be activated and hunt down and destroy cancer. And so there's a real biological basis for believing that the mind and beliefs and attitudes and, you know, meditation, mindfulness, stress reduction can have a positive impact on cancer outcomes.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that, you know, because I don't ever want someone to feel like, oh, it's my fault, I created this. But we can certainly create health. So once you have a diagnosis, whatever led you there, you suddenly can take the reins and be in the driver's seat and turn that dynamic around with exactly what you just described.
Hmm. And so when it comes to diet, I mean, when you bring up the word metabolic, in relationship to cancer, a metabolic approach to cancer, which is the title of the book. It's very reminiscent of Dr. Thomas Seyfried, who I, from reading the book, I think was very influential in shaping your thoughts about the development of cancer. Are you someone who recommends a ketogenic diet? Is that invariably the dietary approach, or is there no one-size-fits-all approach to cancer?
Well, there's definitely a need to address the abundance of sugar we are bathing in today. And so for some people, that's going to be a strict, what we call therapeutic ketosis, which means a level of low glucose with high ketones. When you're testing your blood, it should be somewhere between 3 and 6 or 3 and 7 on the blood ketones and pushing the glucose down. That approach of a therapeutic ketosis can be incredibly powerful to enhance the effect of conventional therapies, especially radiation, because sugar makes our cancer cells less sensitive to the treatment. So we can really use the ketogenic diet as a strategy to make our conventional and non-conventional therapies work better for us. It's also a very important strategy for most brain cancers. And so it's really been shown to be quite beneficial, and in fact, even more beneficial than a lot of the treatment options that are out there, even conventionally, because it's a tough disease process to get your hand, you know, to get your hands around. And then other cancer processes, depending, you know, how aggressive, what the staging is, the person's overall terrain, which we'll finish up here in a bit, what that else includes. Sure. Definitely do well in what's called a nutritional ketosis, which is kind of a 0.5 to 3 micromolar per liter level of blood ketones, which means that basically in our metabolically functioning state, in a natural state of being, when we're all metabolically flexible, we could simply finish our dinner, go for a nice 13 to 16 hour overnight fast. And if we checked our first morning urine in the morning, when we're metabolically on target, we should see some ketones in our urine. That's a natural state of being. However, today, that's a rare find on people to do this naturally. You have to push it in more people because we now are eating more sugar than ever in human history. And we also are starting, thank God, to get off the low-fat kick, which absolutely added to this problem.
So you reject the idea that meat consumption, that saturated fat drives cancer? Is that something that the evidence now points away from? Because there are, you know, stalwart advocates of that theory, you know, vegan nutritionists who state that it's all about our excessive meat consumption, and, you know, they want us to go back to forks over knives.
Right. And I spent the first 7 years of my own diagnosis as a vegan, and another almost 16 years on top of that as a vegetarian. And that was a huge step up from my previous very standard American processed diet that was, there wasn't an alive being within the food I was eating at that time. So it was definitely a move in the right direction. But over time, my chemistry, my tumors, my overall sense of well-being, everything was failing, and I couldn't figure out why, because I was quote unquote doing it all right. So I started to explore and learn more about what my biochemistry and my epigenetics were telling me. And that was a huge eye opener. And so I did start to incorporate some animal protein, but the caveat to this is that it has to be clean. So I'm getting ready to present at a big conference, the Acres Conference, and my topic is you are what you eat, but also what they eat, you know, what your animals eat. And so that's where—
You are what you eat, says, you know, coining a new phrase.
Exactly. And so we've come so far from how our grandparents, you know, the type of animal protein that our grandparents and great-grandparents were exposed to. You do have to look at that. And the vegan community is spot on. We do eat too much protein, okay, because too much protein is also a driver of mTOR, which is a particular metabolic driver of many, many cancer processes. And actually a ketogenic diet, if anyone's actually done their research, a true ketogenic diet for cancer is actually low protein intake. Okay, so your animal protein is more like a condiment. And the focus is more emphasis on high fat, from anywhere from 75 to 90% of your diet is the fat. And then, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20% as your protein, and then, you know, around 5% as your carbohydrate. And so it really isn't, you know, we're really not mincing words too much with the vegan community and saying, yeah, I agree with you on the quality of the protein and the amount of the protein. However, most of us, if you actually do the blood work, will see that we are really overfed and undernourished, and that our chemistry is really depleted, and the main nutrients that are depleted in my cancer population, as well as frankly in my vegans and vegetarians, which is vitamin D3, selenium, magnesium, zinc, B12, and vitamin K2. And so I test for those, and I see patterns of those throughout the labs, and we're able to adjust, you know, test, address, and assess on a regular basis to alter our dietary needs as the body dictates.
Should we circle back to the terrain 10, where you're going to complete your metaphor about the tree?
Sure. And so we started talking about one of the branches just now, which is that of the metabolic, the fuel source, which is really talking about how we've become sugar burners over fat burners. So the carbohydrate sugar piece is big. Then, of course, the other big exposure we've had that's one of the big trunks are the toxicants, mm-hmm. the environmental issues. I mean, boy, how do we change things drastically since World War II? We have over 60 to 80,000 new chemicals on the market, with less than 200 of them tested properly to make sure they're safe. And we're not even really testing yet on the cumulative effect of all of these and what kind of soup, you know, we make when we put it all in the container together. We already covered the microbiome of the soil and the canopy of the epigenetics. But another big one, and we alluded to this too, was the immune system. Now, the immune system kind of rises out of the microbiome, out of the gut. But the immune function, it's really hard to completely push cancer back if your immune system isn't working properly. That's what, it's almost like we come in with the knife of the surgery or the chemo or the radiation or the targeted therapies and kind of cytotoxically reduce, cut back the tumor burden. But the way our body truly overcomes it is for the immune system to swoop in after and clean this up. And I'm finding more and more often that patients had a broken immune system before the diagnosis, and it's even more destroyed after the treatment. And that's why we see a 70% recurrence rate in folks who've already had cancer once. Mm. Likely they have a 70% chance of having it again. And if we can really address the immune system, we can alter that.
And the irony of it is that the very self-same treatments that are designed to kill the cancer increase our susceptibility to cancer recurrence because they're immune suppressive. So that is a fundamental flaw with our current approach to cancer.
Yeah. And then interestingly enough, you talked about the immune therapies, and there were five, I mean, you get to realize just a couple of years ago that still the conventional community was disregarding the immune system having any function in cancer. And yet today it's all the hot topic. It's where all the research dollars are going. And the weird thing about it is that these therapies do not work well in bodies that have already been beaten up by previous treatments. Most folks aren't offered these immunotherapies until
as a last resort. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And so you have to have, number one, an intact immune system for those immune therapies to work on. And if you didn't have an autoimmune condition prior to your cancer treatment diagnosis and treatment, you definitely will after. And what happens when you put these immune therapies into these bodies that have an autoimmune tendency is you will often wake up a big sleeping tiger and put people into some pretty aggressive autoimmune kind of organ failure scenarios, which we see unfortunately too often.
Yeah, we do see that with the melanoma treatments, especially with these new drugs, powerful drugs. Okay, this is a good point at which to pause because our listeners know we divide these podcasts into two parts. You've laid the groundwork for our discussion of your new book, The Metabolic Approach to Cancer. Today, we're with Dr. Nasha Winters, who, together with Jess Higgins-Kelly, wrote this book. It's Integrating Deep Nutrition, the Ketogenic Diet, and Non-Toxic Bio-Individualized Therapies. It's a very comprehensive look at cancer and many ways to fight it. When we return, we'll talk more about the metabolic approach to cancer. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.